Previously on Willing to Adapt.
It's Lemony Snicket's
Are you actually sincere right now?
No, I'm actually sincere.
Jeez.
Children of Unfortunate Events or something?
Lemony Snicket's The books are characterized by Victorian Gothic tones and absurdist textuality. The books are noted for their dark humor, sarcastic storytelling, and anachronistic elements. A word here which means pieces that do not fit within each time period.
Uh-huh.
Olaf, who pretends to be a sailor named
Captain Sham.
Sham. She starts to... Did you just get that?
I actually did not catch on to that till right now.
Oh. So you did not enjoy reading these books?
Not really. They were a slog, I'm not going to lie.
But when you're listening to Tim Curry talk, which...
It's different.
It's different. Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt. And welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
This is the second episode in our Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, where we will be discussing specifically the 2004 adaptation, the film.
Correct.
The very first one.
Correct.
So if you missed our first episode, we talked about the book, specifically the first three, but we did discuss some of the mysteries and VFD, the secret organization, and some of the background material that you would need to understand in order to understand the adaptations.
Correct.
All right, so when was the first time you watched this film?
Do I really need to answer that question?
No, it was not.
It was. Well, considering I'd never read the books, and...
I shouldn't be surprised. I'll be surprised when you, watch something before I did.
Just don't ask Romy. Just assume the answer's no.
Is that your autobiography? Don't ask Romy?
Probably. So, I remember when the movie came out, but it was, 2013, you said? 2014?
The movie?
What did you say it was?
2004.
Oh, 2004.
You were in your 20s.
I did not have a kid yet. In fact, it probably came out shortly. I got married in 04, the first time I got married. And so children's movies, kids' movies, anything like that was pretty much, unless it was a Disney movie, I probably was not going to watch it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Even then, there's a lot of Disney movies you didn't watch then.
That's true. Yeah, there's a lot of, that era, I would say everything from probably...
The Dark Ages.
It kind of was from about early 2000s, mid 2000s up until maybe around COVID time. There's a lot I missed. I think I started watching more superhero and Star Wars stuff during COVID, and there was other things that people would drag me to that I enjoyed, and like Cinderella, our previous podcast. So there were things that I did enjoy and watch, but it was kind of far and few between.
Sure.
How about you? I'm assuming since you were a fan of the book, probably their opening day.
It was not their opening day because I went with my parents. I think I was 11.
Okay.
So, yeah, definitely not by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to see it in theaters, but I had already read several of the books.
Okay.
So I was excited to watch it.
So the first book came out... In
1999.
But he would have been around, the fourth book at this point?
Let's see here.
Wasn't finished with the series yet.
No, he definitely was not.
Okay.
He was not. Okay. He was almost done with the series.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But to be fair, when the movie came out is not when they started working on the movie.
Correct.
So he was at least halfway through the series.
Okay.
Yeah. He was at least halfway through, but he probably knew what he was going to be doing for most of the series.
Because the reason I bring that up is in the last podcast, we talked about how you couldn't find anywhere whether he knew from the beginning what was going to happen or whether he wrote the first few books and then kind of fleshed it out afterwards.
Yeah, you could kind of tell that he knew generally what he was doing. And it definitely seemed like there was a lot that he was going to do that he was preparing for, But it also seemed like there were some things, especially like with VFD, that he ended up writing about, but then it was just, there wasn't enough to hint at it early.
Okay.
That made me, it made me wonder, like, how much of it did you know?
Did the movie spoil anything for
you? A little bit.
Okay.
A little bit, but not enough.
Okay.
The movie does its own thing a little bit.
Yeah, I kind of figured.
Yeah. Did you enjoy it?
So to add on to your one of your last comments in the previous podcast, it probably was my favorite of the three.
There you go. Yeah. It's definitely the most approachable, I think. I think it's... Some people have criticized it for softening the hard parts of the book too much and the darker elements. In my research, it did sound like the movie was a little darker, and then the company wanted them to make it more family-friendly.
Oh, okay.
So the final edit was a little different than the first.
Okay.
But it was, I don't think it was by much. I think they just toned down a few things and like didn't quite show everything.
Okay.
But I'll just say real quick, the 2004 film adaptation was directed by Brad Silberling, and it was a screenplay by Robert Gordon, and it was based on the first three novels of the book series, The Bad Beginning, The Reptile Room, and The Wide Window by Lemony Snicket. It stars Jim Carrey, Liam Aiken, Emily Browning, Timothy Spall, Catherine O'Hara, Billy Connolly, Cedric the Entertainer, Luis Guzman, Jennifer Coolidge, and Meryl Streep, with Jude Law as the voice of Lemony Snicket.
Who was Catherine O'Hara in the movie?
It's Jessica Strauss.
That's right.
So it was kind of fun when they brought her back for the Netflix version.
I forgot about that. I forgot she was in the movie.
It had a budget between $140 and $142 million, and it made $211.5 million at the box office, so it did very well. And the idea was they wanted to turn it into a franchise, but for obviously one reason or another, it did not turn into a franchise, like Harry Potter. One of the reasons being that by the time they would have gotten around to a sequel, the children would have not been children.
Okay.
So there was a lot of talk about making any sequel in a different medium. I guess at one point they were talking about making a sequel stop motion.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I guess would have been very interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were just working with what they could do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a Nickelodeon movie. They purchased the film rights to Handler's book series in 2000, and they began development immediately. And at first, you'll find this interesting, the film was going to be directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who directed the Netflix series.
Interesting. That is interesting. Huh.
So I get the impression from everything that I've read
that
he really wanted to do it from the beginning. And then when it didn't work out that he would do it, he always still wanted to do it. And so then eventually, and we'll talk about it when we get to Netflix, but it sounded like he always wanted to keep doing it.
Yeah.
But Barry Sonnenfeld's a very interesting choice because he's the one that did the two Addams Family movies.
Oh.
So that makes a lot of sense that they would go with him.
Interesting.
Because that works.
Mm-hmm.
So originally, Daniel Handler was attached to write the screenplay, and he put a lot of work in to create the original screenplay for the film when it was going to be under Barry Sonnenfeld. And Jim Carrey was Count Olaf from the beginning.
Okay.
Even with Barry Sonnenfeld, they wanted Jim Carrey. But there's different... They've never fully explained why this happened, which I think in the industry this is very common. It seems like in the industry, people kind of come and go for one reason or another, depending on management and money and so on and so forth. Eventually, obviously, Barry Sonnenfeld left. And it's difficult to figure out if he was fired or if he left of his own accord or what. But it also sounded like it was a difference in what people wanted to do. I guess they were also not sure if they could the company could afford to do it. And so Paramount went and were able to get DreamWorks to partner with them to fund the film. And so I think with high up executives, I think it got a little complicated from what I could tell. And so obviously, you know, there was a switch up there. And it's from what I could tell, it sounded like it was relatively amicable and like it wasn't like a huge dramatic thing, but who knows. And what I found interesting about it is Daniel Handler He said that he was a little upset that he had put so much work in and that they ended up not using any of his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he never like held a grudge or anything. Like he understood why they didn't go with him, because he's very aware that he was attached to Barry Sonnenfeld's work and that a Barry Sonnenfeld movie would be very different than a Brad Silberling movie.
Hmm.
And so he wasn't surprised they didn't go with his script for the new one. So they end up going up with Robert Gordon. And I didn't know this until I did the research, but Robert Gordon's really interesting because he wrote the screenplay for Galaxy Quest.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he also wrote the screenplay for Men in Black 2.
Okay.
And among other films, he did the screenplay for one of my favorite movies, Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
I've always wanted to see that.
It's so good.
Yeah, I played a game similar to that.
Watch it on a TV that's older.
Okay.
Like, not a newer one, like a digital one. Watch an older TV.
Okay.
It looks better. Because it's heavy CGI.
Yeah.
And so on the new TVs, it just looks like terrible.
Oh, that's older CGI. Okay.
Yeah. But on an older TV, it doesn't look that bad.
Hmm. Okay.
Different formatting. Anyway, and then Brad Silberling is interesting because you know what his first movie was?
Mm-mm.
Casper. It's a good one.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a very good one.
I liked what I watched of it. I vaguely remember.
Watch it for Halloween.
Okay.
It's a good one.
I'm pretty sure I've seen most of it, if not all of it, but yeah.
I'll just say I like that because when you know the movies that these two people have worked on,
mm-hmm.
this adaptation makes a lot more sense.
Mm.
Because both the director and the writer have worked on films that handle comedy and sadness very well together.
Yeah, I can see that.
And they can get a little sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that from both of them, they can have a lot of heart.
Mm, okay.
Which I appreciate. Mm. They have depth.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I love about this movie now, which mm-hmm. I didn't care about as a child, is it was shot entirely using sound stages and backlots.
Hmm.
They limited the CGI as much as possible.
Okay.
There's a couple of scenes where they had a digital Sunny.
Yeah.
And a couple of, you know, touch-ups and things like that, but almost, and like leeches, obviously, but almost everything was practical.
Interesting.
Yeah. There was even a couple robotic Sunnies.
Wow.
Yeah.
A couple of times
when she's in the cage, yeah. It's a robotic Sunny.
Okay.
Because they didn't want to put the real baby in the cage.
Yeah, that'd be weird.
But you can't even tell. I think one of the criticism this movie gets is for Jim Carrey's performance. There's a lot of people who thought that he made the character too funny.
Hmm.
And that he took away too much of the darkness of the character. What I think, and what I've come across some other people online who think, is that Jim Carrey does a great job of balancing the character.
Mm, okay.
And that he can be really funny, but he seems like he's almost being... He's being funny in a condescending way,
mm-hmm.
which is still a negative aspect, which mm-hmm. I think works. But then a lot of the times his over-the-top nature works really well for the fact that he's supposed to be an actor.
Mm, yeah, I saw that.
But I think he still does a very good job of being scary. Like, he definitely can go back and forth between the two.
I didn't think he was as
well, because in the
dark,
book, Count Olaf just evil.
Yes.
Like, so, evil, manipulative, terrible.
I personally liked his performance.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it, and you know I'm not a big Jim Carrey. In the old days, his comedy movies were not my thing.
Well, because I think he's not a goofball in this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's funny, but he's funny in a very theatrical way, and then... But then because he'll turn around and he'll just be evil.
Yeah, so I watched it on DVD.
Okay, yeah.
And so I got to watch some of the...
Yeah, behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And I got to watch... I watched part of his screen test where they give you four different ones.
Oh, yeah. You can see how many changes. And...
I enjoyed it. I really sat... Like, I do appreciate...
He's a very good improviser.
He is. And I've appreciated... I think as I've gotten older, I've appreciated some of his later stuff. But I thought he did a good interpretation of Count Olaf that was a bit different from the book.
I've always liked Jim Carrey and I think he's hilarious in this movie.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
he has a range and I like it. But what one of the things about this movie that I also thought of, because we just talked about Cinderella,
mm-hmm.
the live action one,
mm-hmm.
this movie is gorgeous.
Yeah.
the cinematography is just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you watch it and it's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. No,
again, it's one of those movies you could pause it at any time and it's like you're looking at a painting.
Mm-hmm. It lent towards a Tim Burton-ish type feel without mm-hmm. quite getting there.
And that's interesting you say that, because one of the original directors that Nickelodeon was thinking of was Tim Burton.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they had him attached briefly.
Okay.
And I guess, of course, Johnny Depp was going to be involved, which I think is hilarious.
I know.
But I don't know who he was going to be. But
Sonny.
Right. But I guess when they didn't end up going with Tim Burton and Brad Silberling took over,
mm-hmm.
he wanted to stay true to the aesthetic.
Mm.
And so I guess when I was reading it, he said that he almost even kept Tim Burton on as like a consultant or a partner or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then he ended up just staying with the aesthetic, but making it his own, obviously.
Yeah.
Which makes sense why you said that.
Yes, and that's why I got it does explain why I got the feel of it being Tim Burton-esque.
Right.
Without actually being there.
Exactly. Yeah, the film is really, really interesting because a lot of people I've said have criticized it for making it too family-friendly
mm-hmm.
and dumbing down some of the darkness in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other criticism the film gets is that it just rushes through the story.
Oh.
Because it condenses three stories into one.
Yeah. Coming directly from the books,
yeah.
I did not mind that.
You didn't care.
Yes, because in the books, for me as an adult, it was drawing out.
It's a slog.
And so all of a sudden to have it all in one movie,
mm-hmm.
I appreciated that.
It cuts
better.
The fat.
It does.
Yeah, it doesn't need to tell you exactly how the children do everything,
mm-hmm.
but it shows you that the children get it done.
Correct.
The film went through, obviously, many iterations with the script, and what was interesting about this one is, I guess they consulted with Handler quite a bit, but he mm-hmm. didn't end up writing the script, obviously, in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I guess he still likes the movie. It seems like he's very aware of the difference in mediums, and so he doesn't mind that changes were made.
Mm.
And I also say that because he went on to write the screenplays for the Netflix show, and well, he had a team helping him. It wasn't just him, but he technically helped lead it. He gets writing credit, but there's definitely changes that were made in that one, so yeah. You know he's okay with changes. Anyway, but one of the things that I really appreciate about the film version is its emphasis on family.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. One of the themes in the movie that is hinted at in the books, but not in the specific way,
mm-hmm.
is the idea of sanctuary. The idea mm-hmm. of having a safe place that you can build for yourself,
yeah.
or find for yourself, that you can go when times are difficult so that you can be safe, essentially.
Mm.
Like, that's a common theme in the film. That, again, is only more suggested in the books, mm-hmm. but is definitely there.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, the subject of loss plays really heavy in the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's heavy in the books, but I feel like it has a lot more gravitas in the film.
Mm.
Whereas in the books, it feels very matter of fact.
It is, yeah. It's kind of just glossed over. Oh, children, your parents are dead.
Right. Well, and it's also a little different because you can visually see them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You can see their reactions. You can see them coping and trying to adjust. One of the things I really loved this time around watching it, after reading the books this time, is I get the impression that in the movie, you see the children learning to come into their own by the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in the first part of the movie, the whole part with them with Count Olaf is mm-hmm. all just basically exposition.
Mm.
And so then when they go to Uncle Monty, it's them trying to move past that and grow and adapt
mm-hmm.
and learn how to move on and so on. And then by the time they get to Aunt Josephine, they're becoming much more active.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing things to help themselves and help other people and so on. And so when they get to the very end, it seems like they've become their own people.
Yeah.
And I like that because the books for sure are definitely very episodic.
Mm-hmm. Which works in the next series, but and that's why I think with the movie it was so, like, I did not mind them merging all three together and mm-hmm. even twisting the story quite a bit.
What I really love about the film, which the Netflix show does too, just differently, is it shows more of their world.
Mm.
And it feels more tangible. And obviously, it's very anachronistic, and they infuse some steampunk elements into it.
Mm-hmm.
I was a fan of it, and I don't know if I'm a fan of it because I was exposed to it when I was, or if I'm a fan of it now because of the film, which it's odd to say, but because I watched it when I was 11, right?
Yeah.
But because it's such a specific aesthetic, I would make the argument it looks like a lot of the costumes look very like 1905.
Okay.
Very late Victorian, early Edwardian. And another reason why it looks a little Tim Burton is the costume designer does almost every movie that Tim Burton does.
Oh, okay.
I know her name, it's escaping me. And so in the books, you never really know where it's set. The illustrations help you a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but it's still very nebulous. The film chose to look, I think, more at some of the auxiliary literature, like specifically for the time, the unauthorized autobiography.
Okay.
Because a lot of the pictures and things in that are very turn of the 20th century.
Mm,
and so you get a sense of history and a bygone time
mm-hmm.
and stuff, which I like, obviously. But so I think they went a little bit more that route for that reason. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. They don't really ever tell you why they do what they do.
Yeah.
But I really like because you get the really big puffy sleeves and... It's interesting because they specifically set the city in Boston.
Mm.
And so they actually filmed some in Boston.
Okay.
Like some of the exterior shots and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can really tell with when you look at like the Baudelaire Mansion mm-hmm. with all the buildings around them, with all the brickwork and stuff, it's meant to feel like it's in a city like Boston.
Oh, okay.
So they constantly give you the impression of a real reality, but then... It's just different enough that it doesn't fit.
Mm.
Yeah. And so they stuck with that time period in regards to like even Uncle Monty because they went with like an arts and crafts style for his house.
Mm, okay. Yeah.
Very warm, very natural looking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
His was the one with the giant door.
His was the one with the reptile room. It had a lot of yellow interior.
Okay.
It's all right. Don't worry about it.
It's been a while.
That's not important to remember.
It's just going to bug me now.
One of the things about the movie that was very interesting is we talked about this a little bit with Cinderella and some other adaptations is they knew what audiences were going to expect. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of played on the expectations a bit. And so then they kind of messed a little bit with the plot.
Mm, okay.
And because they were combining three books into one, which some people have criticized because you have to rush through them, I also think works in their favor because if you try to make a film off of just the first one, it would be horrible.
That would have taken forever.
Right. But in the movie, the thing about the movie that I found interesting is they were the first to create the concept of the spyglass.
That threw me off because I remember I told you, I think in the last episode that I listened to it on audio. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when they introduced the spyglass and I'm thinking to myself, was that in the book? Did I miss that in the first mm-hmm. chapter?
Yeah. So the movie was aware of the other books that had already come out in the series. And mm-hmm. so they knew where the series was going and they obviously read the auxiliary books and stuff. So they wanted to piece in some stuff in there that hints at stuff later on.
Okay.
And so, like, even in the movie when they go and they stop at the train track and they go to the Last Chance place.
Yeah.
That's a place that appears in the Hostel Hospital.
Oh, okay.
And so it's like an Easter egg. So they do things like that if you've read the books, you know, oh, okay, cool, that's from this book. And, oh, cool, that's an Easter egg. And, oh, look at that, you know.
Yeah.
And so they do things like that, which shows a great respect for the material.
Mm-hmm.
But they also were not afraid to change it to fit the medium and to fit the pacing and things like that. Because this podcast has really given me a new respect for how people adapt things. But the film, it creates the idea of the spyglass being something that all members of VFD have.
Mm-hmm.
And this time around, I realized, the film decided to do that because in the book, the children slowly pick up on what VFD is.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do that in a film. You have to visually give the audience and the character something to realize that something is different. And it'll tie people together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so by giving each of them something that they all have, mm-hmm. it clues you into it.
Mm.
So I thought it worked really well.
So does the spyglass show up in the books?
Nope.
No, that's completely for the
It's
twos.
Completely for the movie.
Two medium.
And then they ended up putting it in the show as
and
well.
Netflix.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in the movie, it's almost like a token. Like, it seems like it doesn't really have much of a purpose
mm-hmm.
other than like a philosophical purpose, like a metaphorical purpose.
Okay.
Because, like, what do you use a spyglass for?
Spying?
Well, to see things, right?
Yeah.
Like, to figure out where you're going or what's coming and mm-hmm. to uncover truth, stuff like that, right? Like, I think that's why they went with that.
Okay.
Also, just the idea of it being adventurous, mm-hmm. you know? It's something easy and small that anybody can hold on to.
Yeah.
Other than like a compass, you know?
Yeah.
Because a compass doesn't do much. Like, it tells you how to get where you're going, but if you're trying to be on theme with what VFT is,
yeah.
I thought it was a relatively good choice.
Besides, they'd already used the compass with
exactly.
Captain Jack Sparrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look in the Bad Beginning, when the children first go to their burnt out mansion
mm-hmm.
and they find the spyglass, but he can't take it because it's so hot because of the fire,
mm-hmm.
next to it is a small insignia that actually says VFD.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, it happens so fast that if you're just watching it for the first time, you mm-hmm. miss it.
Okay.
I think it was a good choice to include VFD as much as they did in the film,
mm-hmm.
even though if you think about it, they don't include it very much.
No.
Because it's just enough interest to keep the audience invested.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ties all of them together in a way that it builds.
Yeah.
And so it makes it less episodic and more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's more of a linear storyline.
I think it worked. Yeah. I liked it.
So by the time you get to Uncle Monty, they introduce the idea that he had a family and children that died in a fire, which on one level is good writing because it makes the children connect to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also makes it interesting because it hints that that's partly why he is in VFD when you find out later, because he's investigating these things.
Mm.
In the book, he never was married and never had children.
Yeah.
So they added that in. But again, I think it worked for the writing. And then by the time you get to Aunt Josephine, you find out she was a part of VFD with her husband, Ike.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time that you hint that she has become more afraid over time because of the tragedies in her life.
Yes,
Because
caught that.
That's where you get all the pictures of all the things that she used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And all the crazy things she did, like flying on a plane on the wing and horseback riding and taming sharks or whatever. I know all these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's more approachable in that, like, it's something that she could have done, technically, you know? But because of the death of her husband and, like, all the terrible things in life, she's just gotten more and more scared. And so the movie went that route,
mm-hmm.
which makes her character much more compelling.
It was my favorite version of Aunt Josephine.
Mm-hmm. Because you can tell she really cares for the children, but she's just dealing with really bad phobias.
Yeah, yeah. And then who was the actress who played her?
Meryl Streep.
Yeah, that's right.
She's amazing.
She, like I said, she was my favorite
I don't think
version.
I've seen her in anything I don't like, so... No, she did an amazing job.
She did.
Yeah, there's a fragility to her character
mm-hmm.
that was really great. And even though she's still not the best guardian because she would have totally given the children over to him
mm-hmm.
in the end, like, you still feel kind of bad for her, you know? But, yeah, so by the time you get to her, that's when you learn a lot more about VFD because Ike's room is locked up, which, again, not in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out later on when the hurricane hits that they have been investigating fires.
Yeah.
Because in the books, you never figure out why the children's home burned down.
Mm-hmm.
There's suggestions and there's ideas, but you never know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so the movie flat out tells you it was Olaf.
Yeah. I caught that.
Yeah. But you build to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so... In the beginning, they add in the bit about nobody knows the cause of the Baudelaire fire, but he adds in, all they could find out is that it was started by a direct blaze from far distance or something like that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it foreshadows that.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time you get to Aunt Josephine, you see, like, this diagram that you find later on in Count Olaf's tower that the children are not allowed to go into.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, the children are not allowed to go into the tower But there's never really any reason why they can't go into the tower. Because later on, they're, like, trapped in the tower.
Yeah.
And so, like, the idea is, like, it's just his area. He doesn't want them there. But in the movie, they take that the route of, you're not allowed up there because I literally have a secret up there. That they end up uncovering.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, I think for purists, there's people who don't like that. But I think for a script, it was well done.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And so the one thing that I found really interesting is, well, one, in the movie, they say, Aunt Josephine says, the Baudelaire parents were their leaders, which is not the case in the books.
No.
But, and it's interesting because it makes the sense that in the movie, the VFD has not been around as long.
Oh, okay.
That it's only been around maybe that one generation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the books, it seems like something's been around a long time. Mm. And it's just like adapted and changed and stuff. So again, a little different. But the fact that they come back to it and they clue into it and stuff really makes it intriguing. And adds that mystery element to it.
Yeah.
Which is found later in the books.
Okay.
But the one thing I remember watching the movie the first time I watched it is... And you tell me this too. When you watched it, were you confused when they didn't have the play at the beginning?
Not really. I caught on once they went on that trip to the train. Yeah.
Yeah.
That, okay.
This is different.
This is different.
Yeah.
I wonder how it's going to play out.
Yeah.
And then once they went on to Uncle Monty's, I just kind of assumed they would either it would show up later. Yeah.
And so I remember watching it the first time. And I remember really liking the train sequence when I was younger, because even though I knew it wasn't from any of the books, it felt like it was. Like, it felt true to the books.
Yeah.
Like, it definitely felt like something that would have happened. And the way they handled, like, how they get out of it felt true as well.
Yeah.
And the reason they did that, obviously, is because they knew they wanted to keep the play where Count Olaf tries to marry Violet. But they knew that for the structure of the screenplay, it was not going to work to put it in the beginning. So they knew they wanted to put it at the end, because if they were combining all three, they needed a way to tie it all up, right?
Yeah.
And so they put it at the end, but then that meant that they needed a reason that the children could not be with Count Olaf to get them to Uncle Monty.
I thought that was cleverly done. They took him away without him actually being evil yet.
Right. Yeah. It felt true to the character of Mr. Poe. It's like, I'm taking the children away because you were going to let Sonny drive the car, which is not a good guardian.
Yes.
And so it's like, well, it's good they're being taken away, but they're being taken away for the wrong reason. And so you'll notice they even changed it a bit. So when they get to Uncle Monty, when Uncle Monty is killed by Count Olaf as Stefano, in the end... They make it very clear that Mr. Poe thinks that it was not Count Olaf, but Stefano who did the killing. And so he's like, don't worry, children. The police are looking for Mr. Stefano.
Yes.
And the doctor, you know. And the children are just like, okay. They're just like, sure they are. But because they did it that way instead of Mr. Poe realizing it was Count Olaf, it makes it so that he's more inclined to give the children back to him at the end.
Yes. Yeah. And I liked how they did that.
In the books, it sounds like Count Olaf knows the laws and he knows how to get the children and get their money and stuff. Whereas in the movie, it seemed more like he was almost flying by the seat of his pants. And he's like, I'm just going to get the children and I'm going to kill them and get the money, not knowing that that wouldn't work until the end.
Yeah.
And so when Mr. Poe tells them, well, the only way you would get the money is if you were a direct family member or married. And so then that gives him the idea to make the play.
Yeah.
So I thought, even though it was different, I think they wrote it very well.
No, I agree.
Yeah, it definitely seems slightly abrupt a couple of times, like how they get to Uncle Monty, how they get to Aunt Josephine, and then when they go to the play, it's slightly jarring how it changes, but... They did so well with the continuity that I buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I liked it. I thought it was a really, really good adaptation.
The other really big change. Remember we were talking about Cinderella and we said that Kenneth Branagh said, this is a story that everybody knows. What do you do with that? What do you change? What do you adapt? How do you make it your own without destroying it? This was very similar because it was so popular that when they were making the film, I think they purposefully made some changes, but in a way that befit the script and what they were trying to do. Because they went the route that Olaf was the cause of the fire, and it kind of like, the film's made very well that it didn't need to continue.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It did. It did. I mean, I saw where they outlined an area for a franchise.
Yeah. But like, you could tell like it could have gone on. Mm-hmm. But whereas the books, it's very much like, I kind of want to keep reading to know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
With a movie, it's almost like a package deal. Like it gives you the essence of the series in this one small thing.
Enough of a closure for you to be satisfied with the movie.
Right.
Because
in the end, Olaf is still missing. Like, he's still on the run.
Yeah.
And so the children are probably going to encounter him again, but there's enough closure that it feels satisfying, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember watching it when it came out, and then when it got to the play at the end, I remember thinking, oh, cool, they do it. But then I remember when I was watching it, because I knew that the way out of it was that she writes with her left hand.
Yeah.
But then in the movie, she goes to do that, and then Olaf says, right hand.
Yeah, I noticed that.
So I liked it because it's very similar to with Cinderella, how they mess with the audience.
Yeah.
Because they play with the expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, well, if they don't get out of it that way, how do they get out of it?
Yeah.
And because they went the route that Olaf is the one who burnt down the family house, it's like poetic justice that Klaus gets up there and he uses the material to save the day.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
That he ends up burning the marriage license.
Mm-hmm.
Which some people have thought was weird. It's like, well, you're still married. But I go back to if the logic of the books is that she can get out of the marriage because she wrote with her left hand, I think the logic would be sound that if the marriage license was burned, they're no longer married.
Yeah, or it hadn't been recorded yet, right, or whatever they do.
Yeah. Like. But the one thing I thought was interesting that the movie does is, I don't know how to describe this. It's almost like it creates a voice for the readers or the audience. Because there are lines and dialogue that are included that are not from the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like when it seems like Olaf has won and he's married to Violet and he's going to get the fortune. And then everybody in the theater finds out about it. And then they're all getting angry and upset and like, how could you do this? You cad. And then I think Mr. Poe says, you monster.
Yeah.
And then Olaf says, I'm the monster. He's like, you're the monster. And he's like, they all tried to tell you. He's like, none of you would listen. He's like, nobody ever listens to children.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, he's saying things that are not in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like an audience surrogate conversation.
Correct.
Like, he's saying things that we all think in a way that we want to hear that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And so it's almost like putting the other characters in their place.
Yeah.
And I like it because those are themes of the book, and they're just being vocalized.
Correct, yeah.
So this is one of those times where the movie made a lot of changes. Oh, one of the other changes is when they're at in the reptile room.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things that I think the movie does better than the book.
Okay.
Remember in the book when they're in the reptile room and you find out that the incredibly deadly viper is a misnomer?
Correct.
And that it's actually like really sweet?
Yeah.
And so later on, Sunny pretends to be attacked by the incredibly deadly viper, even though she's not being attacked by the incredibly deadly viper.
Yeah.
Because she's using it as a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And so then later on, of course, you know, Violet goes and she finds everything she needs to find out and she finds the truth out and she tells everybody and they find out, oh, it's Count Olaf. In the movie, if you remember, when the children are about to be taken away by Count Olaf and his henchmen, Sunny goes over and starts playing with the incredibly deadly viper because Count Olaf, as Stefano, declared that he knows everything about snakes and stuff and he's the one that discovered the incredibly deadly viper. And so he should have warned Uncle Monty that it was so dangerous. And so then the children are like, you didn't discover him. Uncle Monty did, you know, and stuff. But then when Sunny goes over and starts playing with it and laughing and stuff, it shows that he was lying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then they realize, okay, you're not a good guy. And so then they have to run.
Yeah.
So I think it was handled a lot better in the film. Because it's still very much, it felt very true to the books, but making it its own and making that the climax.
Yeah, versus the pretending to get bitten by.
Right. So I think it was handled better in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't know if I just misremembered, but I was so familiar with the movie version that when I read the book, I was confused.
Oh.
I was like, oh, this is different. Because it seems like it just dragged out in the book.
Yeah, I can, well, you know how I feel about the books.
Yeah. The children in the movies definitely are much more level-headed, and I would say a little bit more mature and vocal.
Yeah.
Whereas in the book, it almost seems like there's times where they're like, well, we didn't want to be rude, so we went along with this, you know?
Yeah. I didn't understand that either.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, so what I was going to say is I think this is one of those weird times where the movie made some big changes, and yet it felt so true to the books at the same time.
Yeah.
And so, like, a purist, like I said, would hate it because of the changes.
Yeah.
But when you take it and you can show that you appreciate the books and you love the books and you want to stay true to the books and pay homage to the books, but you're going to change it to befit your medium, then I'm okay with that.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And obviously, I think it's a case-by-case basis. But, and again, some of this is a little nostalgia, but one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this one is I think, like, I think I hinted at this. It's a great way to encompass the series into this one small thing. Does that make sense?
It does.
And so it gives you the feel of the series.
It did.
Without bogging it down.
Correct. Or without leaving you with a cliffhanger.
Exactly.
For a series that never continued.
Yes. So
that would have stunk.
The biggest change, one of the biggest changes for the movie, is the children go back and revisit their house at the end.
That's right. I do. Yeah. I remember that
and
scene.
And so I remember watching it as a kid, and they go in, and at first it looks like it's back.
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a kid being like, what?
For a minute there, too, I got caught up in that. Yeah.
And then, of course, they did the really cool thing where it, like, burns without burning. And then it was just cool because it gives you insight into their mind, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, this is their memories, and yet it's gone. And then there's that bit where they added in where they talk about when Klaus got hit by Count Olaf, and he's upset, and they go upstairs to their little attic room, and he's trying to run away, which is not in the books. They talk about running away, but they don't. And then he says, I'm going to go home. And then she's like, well, this is our home. He's like, this is not our home. He's like, home is where they tuck you in at night and they love you and blah, blah, blah. He says all these things, right? And then that's where they start going into the idea of sanctuary, right? Like, they create a sanctuary for themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like a literal sanctuary, like a physical sanctuary, which I think is like the film version of the psychological sanctuaries the children create for themselves in the books.
Okay.
Because in the books, it's a lot more practical. It's a lot more like, well, we're going to make a best of a bad situation.
Yeah.
Better something than nothing. In the movie, it was much more of a visual. Like, we're literally making a sanctuary kind of thing. But they introduced the idea of, that's not in the books, that their parents wrote them this letter when they were gone on a long trip.
That's right. And they find it.
And then they said they never got it, and they thought that their parents had abandoned them. And then their parents came home, and they felt bad because they thought all these things.
Yeah.
And then when they're at their house, in the end, the letter actually shows up, finally. And it had gone to all over the world.
Yeah.
But it gave you such catharsis at the end, because it tells the children and the listeners everything that you need to hear at the end in order to walk away feeling satisfied. And so it gives you enough of a glimpse of hope that you're fine. And of course, it's like, it's them like initiating them into VFD a little bit too. Because they give them the spyglass.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, all that's brand new. But it's also a way that you can look back on everything that they did. And it paints everything in a better light.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. It was just, it was a very heartwarming movie.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Some back behind the scenes here. When they were going to make this, they knew they wanted to make practical sets. And all of the major studios were basically full when they needed them. And There was one scene where they were able to use a pre-existing stage, and two stages actually, and that was the scene where they were on the street in front of Count Olaf and then Count Olaf's house. They were all connected in two big stages.
Oh, okay.
And it was literally two stages together, and so they seemed like they did a lot of this where they used negatives to their advantage. And so originally they were going to have the house like right next to Justice Strauss's house, because in the book that's how it is. It's like literally right next to it. Not across the street.
Yeah, I thought so, but I wasn't sure.
But in the when they went to go do it, they couldn't take away the big like supporting wall essentially. And so what they did is they created this fake railroad crossing. Over a bridge thing.
I vaguely remember seeing.
And so they used it to their advantage to create this really dark, creepy tunnel that leads to Count Olaf's house in like the bad area, you know? And so they used it to their advantage. The other really cool thing they did is there was in Downey, I think it was maybe something with planes or something, but there's this gigantic warehouse that they were, somebody was eventually going to turn into a soundstage.
They did eventually,
And then eventually, they did. But this was the first film to use it, and they made it their own.
Oh, interesting.
Because they hadn't yet made it into a soundstage.
Okay.
And so they were able to do whatever they wanted with it. And so they went in, and they literally dug down.
Wow.
Because at that stage is where they had the big bed of water.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they used the same water bed for every scene with water, and they just reset-dressed it. So the briny beach was there, and then Lake Lacrimose was there.
Okay.
And so, like, everything with Lake Lacrimose was there on that same body of water.
That's interesting.
And it was, they said they were at the deepest, it was 12 feet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they got really, and what I loved personally, because, again, I'm old school here, and I come from theater, they did a lot of old school movie and theatrical sets. There's a lot of things they did that were just very traditional, and it worked very well. Like, you know how they did the railroad crossing scene, right? They literally had one big stage for that scene, and it was 360 degrees all around. So they could shoot in any direction, and it would feel like you're in an environment. But they did it with forced perspective. So if you're in that one spot there where the car is, or where the Last Chance place is, that one section was the normal view. As soon as you start walking anywhere, you start looking huge. Because of the forced perspective.
Okay.
And then the train was CGI, but...
Yeah.
But, like, nobody does that anymore. And it was done so well that it's cool, you know?
No, I liked it. I really liked the movie.
Yeah, it definitely has a very soft place in my heart. So I'm glad you liked it.
Yes.
Would you watch it again?
I would. If it was on or something, I don't know if I would. You know, there's so many things to watch these days.
There's definitely things from the movie that I think are hilarious.
Yeah. But I would watch it again.
Yeah. You know what's funny?
What's that?
When the movie was coming out, there was a lot of tie-ins and things. And do you remember in the movie when they're at Aunt Josephine's house? And they're going through the hurricane, and then they have to break the piece of the lumber that holds it up so that they can get out.
Yeah.
And then when they drop the anchor, and then it falls on a duck in a boat, and it goes flying away. You know what it sounded like, right?
Yeah.
It sounded like the Aflac commercial. That was on purpose.
Oh, really?
Because when the movie came out, there were Aflac commercials. I think Aflac had invested money in it for something.
That's
so there were commercials for Aflac that had the duck in the commercials, obviously, but it was like responding to all the horrible things happening in the movie, and it was talking about insurance.
That's funny.
And so they had that little part in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's like just enough that you get it, but like not enough that you're like, okay, come on.
Yeah.
But then
not full product placement with the words flashing in the background.
One of my favorite parts of the movie is when they're at Aunt Josephine's, and this is again new for the movie. They experience the hurricane at her house.
Yeah.
Because in the book, they are on the lake during the hurricane. And it shows them like getting through the lake during the hurricane. And I thought it was, again, I might be biased, I don't know why, but I thought it was a better choice to have them experience it in her house. One, I think from a film standpoint, because it would have been difficult to have a hurricane in the boat and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But also because it gave them the opportunity to do something that's not in the books.
Mm.
And it was something that's just really fun to watch as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everything that Aunt Josephine was scared of coming true.
Yeah, I did catch that.
The fridge will crush you flat, mm-hmm. and the stove will catch on fire,
yep.
and the doorknob will blast into a million pieces, mm-hmm. and like it was just really fun because it was kind of like a nod, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And she happened to not be there for all that.
I know.
That was funny.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was a good movie. I really, coming from the books, I think you even told me to watch the movie first.
Yes.
Before I watched the Netflix series. I'm glad I did. I recognize the differences in the characterizations and, of course, definitely the story.
Mm-hmm.
But whereas I think maybe because I don't have any attachment to the books, it didn't bug me at all. And so also really because of all the things I've learned since we've been friends, I've come to appreciate a lot of this better. So I can appreciate something when it's done well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could just tell that this was a love letter to the series,
mm-hmm.
but he was also not afraid to change it.
Yeah, yeah. They did really good.
Yeah.
Because
there's times where you watch something and then they change things, but it almost seems like they didn't need to,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't make a lot of sense, or it was like a weird, like you're pushing an ideology or something.
Yeah.
But in this one, it was weird because they made a lot more changes than you think they did,
mm-hmm.
but it still felt so true to the story.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
it really made sense.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I agree.
All right. Anything else?
I think that's about it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to this one.
Yes, thank you.
We have one more episode coming out in this little series of unfortunate events. We're going to talk next time about the Netflix streaming TV version. And so stick around for that one because we have a lot to talk about that one. Maybe not as much, but
we'll see.
We'll find out.
I know. I didn't think we would have a lot of talk about the books, and that took a lot longer. There was a lot to discuss on that one. Yeah, so join us next time, everyone.
All right, see ya.
See ya.
Next time on Willing to Adapt. All right, so today we are talking about the Netflix TV show version that came out between 2017 and 2019. 3 seasons, 25 episodes.
It did not play out like I remembered it. I must have a horrible memory.
What was interesting about this one is it also had Daniel Handler, who is the pseudonym Lemony Snicket,
mm-hmm.
as a writer for it. There were some things I was not a fan of at first that when I found out he was writing made me have to reevaluate a little bit.
The books to me are kind of like Little Caesars.
Oh.
the Netflix show
there you go.
Is Domino's. So what's your overall opinion of Neil Patrick Harris?
When I was watching him in this, I just kept thinking Barney. From How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
Just like a more evil Barney.
Mm-hmm.
For those who have not seen A Series of Unfortunate Events, the Netflix show, you know, there'll be, again, some spoilers here for you. So if that is something you are concerned about, maybe go watch it.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please follow or subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also like it if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromy@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.